mathematic definition of what a topos was. So we said that is a category, and is a special category because it allows for much more structure. And the possibility of having so much more structure was because in a topos, there exist certain constructs which are described in terms of category theory, but are not present in every category. But they are present in every topos. And those ones were the initial object, the terminal object, exponential, the pullback, the push forward, and the subobject classifier. Now we got to the definition of the pullback. Now the push forward is basically just the dual of a pullback. So I mean, let's just put it. I can write the definition, but it's in the notes, so there's not much use me just writing it, and there's examples as well. So what we will start off with today instead is the concept of a subobject classifier, which is actually probably the most important object in a topos. So we'll start with that. However, before defining what a subobject classifier is, we actually need to know what a subobject is. So I briefly mentioned it, I think at the very, maybe lecture one or two, I don't remember, when I gave the comparison between an internal and external definitions of sets. I kind of mentioned what a subobject is, but that was for sets, for the external description of sets. Now we want to go a little bit more abstract. However, we'll still start from sets and see how you can abstract properties of being a subobject or subset in that case without having to refer to elements. So first of all, in sets, this we already know. Okay? So you have a subobject in inclusion relation, and subobjects identified with certain elements of S which share a particular property. Now this inclusion can also be written in terms of an arrow, an inclusion arrow, which is injective. So what it means in categorical term is that there is a monic map. So that a subobject can be identified with a monic map, whose domain, codomain is what we're trying to define a subobject of. You go the other way around, so imagine you have a monic arrow. Then what this tells you is that there's something which is the image of this monic arrow, which is the image of F such that X belongs to A as the image of F. I'm not saying there's A, I'm just saying there's the image of F. From this, it's obvious that it is a subobject of S. Okay. And moreover, you can show that there is an isomorphism. We're not saying that they're the same thing, we're just saying that this is morphic. Now obviously, in sets, they are the same thing, in the sense that in sets it makes sense that if you have an object here, then it makes sense to say that the same object actually is in here, as in sets. In a general category, you can't say, because in a general category, all you have is a map between the two. So if you're here, you're in A. If you're here, you're in something that's different from A. There is a monic, that's okay, but all you can say is that this X gets mapped to this one. You can't say that they're the same. You can, at most, say that they're isomorphic. It's not the same element, hence this isomorphism. So this is just to make you understand that subobjects now can't be seen really as having the same elements, but they can be seen as something that is isomorphic to something here. So that most that you can say is that there is a monic map. So a preliminary definition preliminary. In a category, a sub-object of some object, so this is preliminary, yeah? So is a monic from something such that the codomain of this monic arrow is B. Now I said preliminary because this is not quite correct in the sense that it can be the case that you have two maps which are isomorphic, well, which are equivalent, sorry, not isomorphic, which I haven't defined yet what it means, but they're equivalent. And in category theory, this, if they're equivalent, you kind of have to consider as being the same. So that if you had two equivalent monic maps which satisfied this condition, you should somehow consider them as representing the same subobject. That's why it's preliminary. So how do you define this equivalence? In order to define that, you need first the notion of factoring, I think it's called. So what does that mean? So imagine you have a map in some category C, yes? I mean, this is always contextual, always in some category C. So in C, then, if for all or for any map with the same, so for any map that goes like this, there exists another map from C to A such that, well, this diagram commutes. Such that G is equal, actually maybe it goes all the way around. Yes, it does go there. Sorry. So that F is equal to G of H. Okay, if that's the case, then you say that F factors through G. It just can be written in terms of G. Now, if it's the case that you have an F that factors through G, and it's also the case that G factors through F, so it's also the case that you have this then you say that F and G are equivalent. So this is the notion of equivalence. So when each can be factored through the other one, so each can be uniquely defined given the other one, then they're considered equivalent. And given this notion of equivalence, you can now define the proper definition of a subobject. So it's the same, it's just that now you consider equivalence classes. So, in a category, subobject of some element is an equivalent class of maps that they are monic. And the codomain is B. Obviously, how many there will be in each equivalence class will depend on the category and on the details. So it could be the case that there's only one sometimes. But in general, if that happens, then you identify the errors. Now, in the following, every time I will talk about subobjects, I'll define them in terms of monic errors. And you just keep in mind that there's an equivalence class of them, but you just take a representative and do stuff with that representative. In fact, any proof that you can do which uses subobjects is independent of the chosen representative. So from now on, I'll just write F for a subobject, keeping in mind that this is the definition. Okay, so now that we define the more abstract characterization of what a subobject is, we can define what a subobject classifier is. Okay, now as the name suggests, right, what this object does, it classifies subobjects in the sense that it kind of tells you when something is a subobject or something else. And it does so by telling you which elements belong to the subobject in question. Now, obviously, this sentence, elements, subobjects, has different meaning if you're in sets. Or if you're in a general category, right? An element in set is just this, and a general category is this. But it still identifies a subobject by telling you, roughly speaking, what elements belong to that subobject. Now, again, let's start from sets and define this in sets. We kind of already saw it, but now I'm going to be a bit more precise. So in sets, we've already encountered this object, the truth object, which had truth values 0, 1, which you can identify with true or false. Now, there's also an arrow in sets called true, which maps from the terminal object to the truth value object. So in this case, 0, 1. And what this arrow does, it takes, well, the only element that's in here. And true is defined such that it gives value 1 to this element. Obviously, there's an... Eh?
Well, what? It's a strange function to define. Yeah.
True. Well, it's also false. It's true. Oh. There's also this guy. And a bacon. Okay, here, if you want to be a bit, that's how you define it. But no, sometimes I actually write it true and false. Anyway, this is the same, it's just now picks the other element, picks the value false. And in sets is a bit silly, but it turns out that in something that is not so simple, it turns out a little bit more complicated. Anyway, there's false. And gives you value 0, right? Okay. So now, how does this object classify subobjects? But when it goes up, can you see it? Kind of. So how does it do it? So let's do a drawing. So you have a we're in sets, yeah? We have a subset. This is a subset of S, so this is I. So here it makes sense to do points. Huh? Then you have your subobject. Your truth object. And then you have your terminal object here. And now you say that you identify a subset of S by requiring that this diagram commutes. Now, I'll first write it and explain. So this guy is true. So this is an inclusion. So in sets, it really picks this element and it gets you the same element in sets. Then what this arrow does, well, we've already seen this, but it gives you 1 if this is the case, and it gives you 0 if it's not the case. Now, by requiring this diagram commutes, you're saying that this guy should be equal to this guy. Now, this when you have this factorial symbol, normally, because this is the terminal object, there's only one arrow from this terminal object, and you normally denote in factorial as a factorial. You can sometimes put an A, but I mean, it's obvious what it does. It just maps everything to that. So, okay, you go this way or you go that way. I apply this to some element. So if you go that way, you get the characteristic function of fa of x, which is just characteristic function of x. And this, from the definition, gives value 1. If you go this other way, so you get true of this maps everything to the only thing it can map it to, and so you get value 1. So this subobject can be identified by requiring that this diagram commutes. So it basically, this tells you that you get an element if it is an element in the subset of S called A, then you get value true, and yes, that is true, kind of thing. However, it also tells you a bit more than that. It tells you, I mean, it is true that it tells you that thing commutes, but it is a little bit more than just commutes. In fact, your A can actually be identified. With all those elements, such that, hang on, I'll just do it. And this is true. This, so it's all those sub elements of S which get mapped to 1 by the characteristic function, which is the same as saying this, which is kind of the same as saying that this object here, or the arrow associated to it, I mean, there's a one-to-one correspondence between arrows and subobjects. This is the same thing as saying that this arrow is the pullback of true through this map. I mean, this is not, let's do it like this, not rigorously mathematical, but conceptually. So, very big inverted commas. Huh? So what this is telling you is that a subobject is identified by requiring, not only that this diagram commutes, but by requiring that it's actually a pullback. So what it means is, I'm just going to draw it here. So this is monic. Up. So there you have something here. This is again the unique map. This is some other map. So that is the pullback of the arrow true to this map. So what is this saying? the fact there's a pullback tells you that this is equal to this guy here, G. And okay, this is equal to that. And also that the bigger triangle square commutes. So you get that G of XLA is equal to, the other way around. Which you apply to some element x. And you get from here, you get psi a g of x equal, this gives you 1. It has to give you 1, that's the only thing it can give you. So what this means from the definition is that g of x belongs to A. However, from this guy, you know that g of x is equal to this. So since we're in sets, this is really an inclusion as in an element. The same element maps to the same element. So in sets, you can just identify this too. And this is actually how you define this map here. So you define this. And you can show that it is actually, if you define it in this way, is the only map that makes this diagram a pullback. And moreover, also this is the only map that makes this diagram a pullback. So now we've seen that a subobject, that a subobject classifier, how it works is that it gives you this truth object and this arrow true. And then it is such that given any monic arrow, if it's a well-defined monic arrow, so if it really represents, well, if it's a monic arrow, it does represent a subobject, then if you create this diagram is a pullback. And this makes you identify this subset.
In the general category, how would you get this map type? So if you're using this like an indicator function from S down to the subobject classifier, is there any kind of, well, I guess, where does that come from in a general category?
It would be the only one that would make this diagram commute.
Okay. So I guess you mean once you specify so many ingredients of the diagram, the other.
Yes. Yeah. In fact, you can also show this, that for a given set S, there's actually this has more. So, yeah. Given that, you uniquely specify that. But this is kind of easy. I mean, in sets, then you would have, easy to see, really. Oh, okay, this is set. Okay. So how does the general definition go? Of the subobject classifier is as follows. Given a category, subobject is an object call a truth object most of the times, and an error. True, I'm just going to call it T now. From the terminal object. So, okay, this category has to have a terminal object. Yeah? Obviously, otherwise this wouldn't make sense at all. So it has to have a terminal object. So that then you can define a map true such that for all monic maps, there exists one and only one of these maps such that the diagram commutes. Oh, I didn't say where this goes from. As a definition of logic, which in sets is kind of easy to see. Okay, now, so in sets we've said that this guy, true or false, kind of straightforward. In general topos, you have many more elements than just that. Now, first I'll try and describe conceptually what it means to have more elements, then I'll tell you what these elements are. Okay, now a simplified drawing of version of that drawing. So you have your S and you have your A. You have your truth object and sets. It's easy, right? You have the question, does A belong to S? You answer, yes. Does B belong to S? You answer, no. But now imagine you have something like that. And you ask the question, does B belong to S? You wouldn't really know how to answer it. Obviously, you could define the intersection and then say that the intersection belongs to S. But that's not the same as asking, does B belong to S? And so on and so forth. Now, in a general topos, you'll end up with many more values, which have a certain ordering depending on what topos you're considering. So that now, if you ask the question, is B a subset of S, you can actually get an answer. It's going to be somewhere here. And if you have something like this, is that a subset? You still get an answer, which is going to be a bit more down here. Obviously, you have the extreme points, which are the analogs of true or false in a classical sense, but you have other things in between. And this kind of tells you, in a mathematically correct way, what it means to nearly be a subobject or to nearly be true, and how far away from the truth you are. And you can do this in a correctly mathematical way because this collection forms a logic, it forms a Hayton algebra. So it's meaningful to ask to have this kind of mathematical analogs of nearly almost. So this is very roughly what this multivalued logic enables you to do. Now the question is, what are these elements? Now since we're going to consider eventually this topos here for some particular C, I'll analyze what elements of the subobject classifier, well, the truth object in this topos are. And these are what they're called sieves, which to be honest, I'm not quite sure they called it that name, but maybe it makes sense. All right, so what's a sieve? This will be the elements of our truth object. Now, as a sieve, so given, or as an object, This is the general definition, right? So in any category, see? Then a sieve on this object B is a collection of maps such that one, that the codomain of this maps is B, and such that they're closed on the left composition. So such that, so if F belongs to some sieve, let's call this, then given any other map, which can be composed with this guy, then GOF belongs to SIP. I'm not sure if I find the composition. Okay. So that's what it means, it's closed on the left composition. I think that's probably why it's called a sieve. Right? If some one thing goes through, then anything else is going to go through. So let's give some examples of a sieve. Simple category. I'll make up some. Imagine you have this guy. Now we'll denote the collection of all sieves on B like this. So what are the sieves on B? Well, you have. So imagine you consider J, you can have this, just this sieve, that's fine. You can have the sieve of G, but then because of this condition, if you have G in the sieve, then you have to have F and G as well. So you can have G and G of F. You can't just have G alone. Then you can have this too, G, J, G, L, F. You can have the empty one. And then you can have the one with the identity. Now, if you have the one with the identity, because of that, any map which has as codomain B composed with identity will have to belong to the sieve. So, and you would get G, G, O, F, and, well, all of them. And so, and that's it, in this case. So you can see here that you have the minimum sieve and the maximum sieve, which roughly speaking are the analogs of true or false for one context. And this guy here has actually got a special name. It's called the principal sieve. Oops. And you normally write it like this. So if a sieve has the identity, then it's automatically, because of this condition, is automatically the biggest one. Is that okay? Okay, so that's what a sieve is.
You have to include the identity and sieve, for instance.
Right, yes. Yeah. In all of them, actually. But yeah. Okay, I'm not gonna write it down, but yeah, it is true. Because, yeah, if you compose them. Okay, so now another important property of sieves is the pullback. So imagine, take this sieve here, for example. And then you try and define the pullback of that sieve by an element which belongs to that sieve. So what this is, so if you go here, this that sieve there is this guy, this guy, this guy, and that's it. Now if you pull back with this map, it's as if you truncated. So this guy pulled back with this map just gives you nothing. However, this map pulled back by this map will give you this map here. So what this thing is, or the definition is the following. So all those maps from which, see, did I use C as call X to be such that and you get the principal sieve. So this is one of the properties of sieves, that if you pull it back by an element of the sieve, you get a principal sieve on the domain of the arrow you pulled it back with. Okay. Now those are the elements. Now what exactly is the sub-object, sorry, the truth object. Now, I said that we are in this category, in this topos here, for some sieves. Now, we've defined that the elements of the truth object for a given element in the category are sieves. But what is this big object? So it is a contravariant functor from C to sets. Such that for each element, you assign precisely that, the set of sieves. And for each map, you have to assign a map that goes the other way around. How do you do this? It's kind of the definition of this, but now it's a pullback that doesn't necessarily have to belong to whatever sieve you pick here. So you have a sieve, and this you map it to some sieve S prime, which is kind of the pullback. So there's all those elements. Sorry. Stupid. Sorry. Yes. Yeah, sorry. Even here, right? Yeah, sorry. I still get the compositions wrong. This is G, not F or G. Okay, now let's do an example so as much as you. So we'll go here again.
This is a question I want to make. If you have two objects, does the collection of all maps between the two objects always have to be the same?
The collection of all these guys.
I guess I just mean in a general category. Like if you pick two objects, does the collection of all more than just have to be the same?
Yes. But generally, yeah, it has to. Yeah, it generally has to be. Even the collection of objects. So you will have various. Right, the example. So let's try and do this S here. And now there's a G. And now let's give the principal sieve again. I want something without a... Okay, so. Well, no, we can do for this. Okay, let's do it. From B to A. Well, let's pick this one. I'll pick all of them. So first is this guy. If you want to map this guy to a sieve on A, and you look for all those maps which have as codomain A, which composed with this guy, would give you a map to B. That's just zero. You do it for this guy. That's two. Again, you look for all the maps with codomain A, which composed, well, would give you a map on B, and that's F. And since here you also have the identity of A, so it will be F and identity of A. Which is the principal sieve? Which is because of this, yeah? And you obtain the same here, and this just empty sieve. This is how you can map sieves to sieves. So this presheaf, pictorially, again for each object, see, you get a collection of all sieves. So that's one, that's two, that's three, etc., etc. Such that if you have maps down here, you go that way. The entire thing here is this guy. Now we'll see, I'm not doing it today, but we see that an element of this guy will be a section, basically. And this is then what you will use. Oh, I deleted it. As well, when I drew the picture, you know, this guy. Now, these elements here are sections, but we'll do that in the next lesson. So for now, I wanted to define it, and I want to also say that the collection of all these sieves forms a Haitian algebra. So what is a Haitian algebra? Okay, so definition. I know there are a lot of definitions. So a Haitian algebra is a relative pseudo. I don't know whether it goes here, but complemented. Very clear. Right, a lattice. Do you all know what a lattice is? Excuse me? No, no, no. Forget about all this. Lattice. So it's just a, so that's a collection of elements with some ordering. Such that you can always define the least upper bound and the greatest lower bound. That's a lot. Least upper bound, greatest. Yeah. The join and meet. So given any two elements, you can define the greatest upper bound and the least upper bound. So this guy is... least upper bound, hang on, what was the definition? So that this okay, if this is the case such that for all others, I'm trying to remember the top of my head, but prime such that that is true, then this is true. So is the smallest element that is bigger to both. Maybe I wrote it here. No, I didn't, sorry. And this is that's the other way around, so all right. If this is the case, such that for all of element C prime, which this holds, if that's the smallest, so this again is the biggest element which is smallest to both, and this is the greatest element which the smallest element which is greatest to both. So in a lattice, you can always find, given two elements, you can always find an element which is the smallest element which is bigger to both, and you can find an element which is the biggest element which is smaller to both. Was that like? Oh. Plus distributed. This means the following. So that these operations distribute. And the same if you switch them around. Now this instead means the following. Okay, so given two elements in your lattice, then the relative pseudo complement of A with respect B is an object, or an element in C, which always belongs to the lattice, such that first thing, A intersection with C is less or equal to B, and the second condition is that for all other elements in your lattice, if this is the case, then, and also the other way around, then this is the case. This is the definition. What it really means is that this object C is the greatest element of this set here. So you have a collection of elements, and with respect to whatever ordering your lattice has, the biggest element which satisfies this condition is the relative pseudo complement of A with respect to B. In fact, this thing is precisely that. Well, kind of. You can see it as well, how you define is. So now, if you replaced B by zero, so with the minimum element in your lattice, you obtain what you def. Oh, actually, I needed this. Damn it. You define, you obtain what you need, what you mean by negation. I mean, it could also be inclusion, which is a kind of formal implication, really. In fact, we'll see in a special case that we will use, it will be inclusion, that ordering. So if you replace by zero, then you obtain this guy here, which is how you define your negation, and is the greatest element of this set. And this is now the negation. It's not the complement, but it's the pseudo complement. Now, I know I have deleted this guy, but now you can see why. I don't remember which one was this. Oh, that's the biggest one. Now, by this definition of negation, then you really do obtain this. For example, if you go here, get this guy here, for example, and you want to define the negation. So the negation is the biggest element, the greatest element of all those sieves which belong to this guy, which have absolutely nothing in common with RS, S intersection. So what are they? Well, in this case, you've got the empty one and then the principal sieve. Okay, this example is very easy. There's only one of them, but anyway. Yes. Good. Yeah, it would have, yeah. Okay, so if you go here, what are those elements? What are those sieves which have nothing in common with this one? Well, here's this and the empty one. And the greatest element of them is obviously this. So in this case, you get S1. And if you join this two, you don't get the principal sieve. You're missing the identity. So here it's clear that S1 or not S is less than the principal sieve, which is the greatest in this case. In fact, I mean, this is a general definition, but you actually can define it specifically for sieves. So that now this guy is defined as follows. The equivalent is just that this is for sieves. So all those maps, so assume the S now is a sieve on A. Which is exactly the same. Which, in fact, is what we did here, right? So we picked actually this. No, this. This wasn't right, was it? Did you understand why I made a mistake here? Did you? No. So can you see that definition? So not of that is all those arrows, which, if composed with them, don't give a sieve. And this is this guy. And you can't actually compose it. So they don't give a sieve. And that's the relative pseudo complement. It's a little hard to digest, but I don't know. I found always the best ways to think of topological spaces. I think I already said that example. And that's the really best way of understanding what a relative pseudo complement is. because in that case, yeah, you just miss the boundary. It's not, you get this.
Is that the general feature that you can define some kind of
measure
that will tell you that you lack the quality by a little bit?
Interesting. I don't know, I mean, that is the case. It is true that you're almost there. In fact, in the limiting case, when you are there, then you get Boolean, which is still a Haitian algebra. It's just that the measure of that almost would be zero. But I don't know how to have a general formulation to measure how far away you are. Is that what you ask?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's interesting, actually. I don't know if it is. Because, yeah, it would depend on...
You can always count the back up to one.
Yeah, it is probably discrete, yeah. But I don't know if there's a way of calculating. That's quite a good question. I don't know. Because it really depends. I mean, this it was very simple, so it was only for the identity. It could be much more.
Yeah,
but it will all elements.
So. You can be as far from the one.
Yes.
Maybe in general.
Oh, there is a limiting one which minimizes. Yeah, probably you're right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there should be. I wouldn't know how to... I suppose case by case you could be able to define it, that's true. I wouldn't know a general definition. That's a good point. Yeah, how we would. Okay, here would be the only one. Well, I don't know how to generalize it.